Hubbub, a chaotic din caused by a crowd of people.
Hello and welcome back to Season 5, Episode 3 of the Director's Hub podcast, Hubbub. I'm Faye Miller from Gingerbread World, and with me is my co-host Bruce Bignall from Hello. Evolve Pipe Drive. And today we are talking to Helen Guinness of Leaderspeak.
Good morning.
Nice to see you, Helen. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
So let's get started talking about leadership, really, because that's what you're all about. Tell us a bit about Leaderspeak and what it is that you do.
Well, I've been involved in leadership development since 1981, in one form or another. But essentially, when I began engaging in leadership, it didn't exist in the British vocabulary or business vocabulary, neither did coaching at the time. So when I founded my company in 1989, I pioneered both those elements of business as distinctions from management. But at the time, we were in the wake of quality management. And, you know, the whole, if you think about our language, we've got managing directors, we've got senior managers, we've got managers. It's all still entwined in management and language. Is the kernel, the, you know, the centre of leadership. I'm actually reading a book now called Language is Leadership. And I'm a wordsmith. I'm obsessed with language because I feel that we don't say what we mean and we don't mean what we say. We get very lazy with language. And actually people use very often no more than 200 words. And that's insane. We have a vast language and very rich language. I mean, you only have to look at Shakespeare to know that. So as far as I'm concerned, the problem with leadership is that people don't understand the difference between leadership and management. And unless you do, it gets very confusing. And people will fall back on management and call it leadership. When it isn't. Leadership is very distinctly future-focused, whereas management is not.
Yeah. And that, for you, is the definition. That's what I wanted to get from you. What is your clear definition between management and leadership? And it's actually really interesting that you said, cause I didn't know this, I wasn't born, I was born late 80s, but about it, it wasn't even used as a term. So what is management and what is leadership? And then where did leadership as a terminology first come from?
Well, leadership was it came from the military. and it designates hierarchy. So leadership was titular. You were given a role, a leadership role, but you had a title that went with it. And if you didn't have that kind of title, then you weren't a leader. So if you think about the military and the ranks that you go through, and as you get into the more senior ranks, you're then considered to be a leader. Now, the military's changed quite a bit, as well as business, but in business, and big corporates particularly, the distinction leadership is not understood clearly. And what often happens is people are promoted out of their comfort zone. So when you get, for instance, you get somebody who's a brilliant salesperson and they get promoted to sales director. Well, you've just killed them off because their skill is now redundant, but they have had no training in being a leader in that sense, being a sales director. So those are the two principal mistakes, but to give you the specifics of the difference between the two. Leadership is future focused. It's about purpose, vision, mission, goals. Where are we going and what are we going to achieve? So it's always about the future. And the language of leadership is enrolling people in the purpose, the goals, the missions, so that they follow. Because if people aren't following, you're not leading. I mean, that is logical. Whereas management uses the resources on a day-to-day basis to produce the results. So it's actually cyclical in a time sense as much as it is in any other. So you get leadership setting the mission goals, management using the resources to hand to produce the results, which then go into the past. So you've got future, present, past. And then as time goes by, you reset the goals, the mission, purpose, if necessary. Although the bigger vision doesn't change that often, but, you know, the more strategic stuff might. And that's how it works. It's terribly simple, but people make it so complicated.
So when you explain it like that, it does sound really simple.
It is.
I mean, I've heard you speak before, Helen, and you have said in a very abrupt way that leadership is not working at the moment in this country. So what's the disconnect between the two that you think is a problem with British industry these days?
It is what I've just been explaining. It's twofold. It's people being promoted out of their comfort zone. No role models because leadership is broken, to use a kinder word.
We're allowed to swear on the podcast, swear away, so that's fine.
So here's the thing. If you think about it in terms of having a role model or a mentor or someone to look up to or to even copy in terms of leadership, if they don't exist, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You model through and you do the best you can with the resources that you have, but you haven't got any resources to speak of because you haven't been trained in leadership.
Where does the ownership come? If you get offered a role, so let's say you are the top performing salesperson and you get ownership, sorry, you get promoted to the sales director role, who do you think should take some of the responsibility? Obviously there's the employer, but if employees know that actually I'm not a leadership, that isn't what I have in my capabilities, I'm an incredibly good individual contributor, they could have that conversation with their employer. Would that be where does it come from? Like, should is there any responsibility on the individual?
Well, I think no. And let me put it another way. There is a responsibility on the individual, but only from where you and I are looking. They don't sense that they have that responsibility because they're reliant on those above, because we live in hierarchies in this country. And they're reliant on those above to see them through, for want of a better expression. I imagine it's quite rare, but I suspect that people do ask for training. Whether they get it or not is another matter. And if it's broken at the top, it's broken all the way down.
Do you think there's a sort of head in the sand mentality sometimes of like, oh, this person's great, take this sales example again, so we'll promote them, and then, oh, they're great, we'll just leave them to get on with it because we're too busy doing all this other stuff, so we'll just not think about that and we'll just let them crack on and hope for the best?
Well, there is, but the head in the sand is in the sand because of terror.
Yeah.
Fear. People fear being leaders. Leaders get assassinated, whether it's literally or metaphorically.
Yeah.
So people fear being leaders and they avoid it, and it's become a cultural avoidance.
Well, suppose you take the example of the salesperson again. Not only are you putting them into a role which they're obviously a great salesperson, they can sell, whether they can lead, you know, they might have some leadership qualities, they might not. But you're also then setting them apart from their peers, I suppose, as well. So suddenly they're the boss of the people that they were then colleagues and working with, and that does shift the relationship and I suppose can cause friction as well.
All of that.
Yeah.
And it causes so much upset because when people don't know what to do, they make stuff up. You know, as human beings, we hate not knowing. We'd like to know what we're up to, where we stand, you know, all that sort of thing. But when you don't know what to do, you're going to make it up. You're going to do the best you can with what you've got available. So being a brilliant salesperson, maybe you've then got the ability to bring, you know, to sell to people. But how are you going to do that? I mean, if you don't know that the basics of leadership, if you do, then you can sell, you know, in the way that you've done before because you've got that skill.
I think there's something here where you said it quite succinctly earlier. If people aren't following you, you're not a leader.
Absolutely right.
So we talk a lot of this conversation at the moment is about the senior and whatever level of hierarchy that is in the business, local government, wherever that is, right? But you can be a leader in your sales team, in your football team, if people, when they're looking, when something's going wrong, and or you inspire others to, actually, I'm going to follow this lead. Just so if we use a sales example, I can imagine if you're hitting the target the most, but you're not taking anyone else with you, you're kind of you're not sharing your wins. You're not a leader. You're a great practitioner, possibly. Mm. You ain't no leader.
No, because you're isolating yourself and you're doing it for yourself as opposed to the team. Mm. I mean, the whole business of collaboration and partnership is also involved. You need that theme to run all the way through. You need people here who are producing the results to also buy into the mission vision. So actually leadership starts from grassroots. Mm. And we should be developing leaders from the bottom up, not from the top down. And you can be a leader anywhere, anytime, in whatever walk of life. I mean, you lead your own lives, I lead mine. But we seem to separate that notion from everything else. Mm. And as soon as we get into a company and we're promoted into a role for which we have no training, we are afraid. What am I going to do now? What skills am I going to deploy? And I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. So that generates fear. That then creates its own knock-on problems. And when people are afraid, others can sense it. I'm sure you're aware.
So how do businesses overcome this? Is it through training, for example, like you offer, but is it they need training? You said that it's to start from the bottom up rather than the top down. So if you've got a business where leadership is lacking, how do they go about resolving that?
Well, I think it's a twofold thing, really. I mean, you know, from my point of view, I need to get the buy-in from the senior people. Ideally, I want to start with them.
Yeah.
Because they set the culture.
Yeah.
So leadership sets the culture. Leadership sets the pace, the theme, you know, the energy, the heart, the soul, all of that stuff. But at the same time, if you start training people at grassroots, they take responsibility for themselves much more readily. And they will grow and develop in a much more productive fashion. So I think it's actually a sandwich thing, yeah, in a way. I mean, ideally, I just work with the whole company, which is why I prefer to work with small companies,
yeah,
because I can get the whole lot in one go.
Yeah.
Whereas in the corporate sector, it's a whole other nightmare.
Mm. I guess it's the corporate sector. When you've got big companies with hundreds and thousands of employees, then it's like a vast leviathan that it's quite hard to tackle, and especially if a culture isn't entrenched. To actually alter that culture, so then it filters down so people don't feel unproductive, put upon, like they want to leave, not respecting their leaders, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, people want to feel happy at work, people want to feel fulfilled, people want to feel they belong to something bigger than themselves. To coin a much overused phrase, people want to make a difference. And you can't make a difference unless you have an idea of where you're going and what you're up to. Mm. I mean, I use the Japanese philosophy of Ikigai, which is the philosophy of purpose. And within that philosophy, one of the themes is making a difference in your community, whether you talk about a small community or a large community, but essentially you're making a difference outside of yourself. Mm. You're leaving something behind. Mm. You're creating a legacy. And that's what we all need to be focusing on. We've lost that, and it's been particularly badly damaged by COVID and the aftermath. People are feeling very lost, very purposeless, very lacking in direction, not sure of themselves, not sure where they're going, what it's all about. And the majority of the coaching clients I work with are wanting to work on purpose, to find what their life purpose is.
Why do you think COVID did that so much? Is it because we were all sort of separated and socially separated, or the work from home thing has impacted?
I think it's largely because we lived in terror of losing our lives on a daily basis. And because we had no explanation, no reason, no end game, no future. I mean, we lost all sense of where are we, what are we doing, where are we going, what's happening to us. And our lives were threatened on a daily basis to boot. So we were in terror throughout that whole period. And because we were isolated and enclosed, we also lost our connections. Hmm. And now people are still in fight, flight or freeze mode.
Do you think they haven't come out of that?
No.
Still having a severe knock-on effect not. Then?
Yeah.
Wow. I hadn't really thought about it like that, but I guess you're right, because it did. I mean, you know, for me personally, it trashed my business, but in terms of like working from home and all that, I was kind of did that before, so it didn't impact me. But I suppose if that was not your thing, then it would have had a huge impact on your life, as well as obviously the as you say, the fear of a virus that could all kill us at the time. So
yes, I mean, we hadn't had that experience of being isolated and cut off, and it was vehement to start with. I mean, you were in fear of your life in two ways. One was catching the disease, and the other was being caught not obeying the rules.
Oh, I got stopped by the police during COVID. I was legitimately going about my business, but I still got stopped. It was a bit, shades of, you know, times and gone by, if you know what I mean. So, exactly. Yeah, it's quite frightening. Yeah.
No, people are still very fearful. They don't realise it most of the time, but the net result is it's every man or woman for themselves. So it's very self-focused. Everybody is looking after themselves. They're not really engaged in or interested in anybody else. Yet when you have a slightly deeper conversation with them, what they're feeling is lost. So when you feel lost, what are you going to turn to? Yourself, because where else are you going to go? What do you get? You know, you don't have any other resources.
So you mentioned like purpose there, and when you work with people, how do you, if they're lacking in purpose or they feel they're lacking in purpose, how do you work with them to help them find that?
Well, I use some of Simon Sinek's work, Start With Why. I did one of his courses, took one of his courses some time ago now, and he uses a process which helps people to identify impactful events in their lives, both positive and negative. And I ask people to talk about those events, and I don't interject or ask questions, I simply let them talk, and then I pick up significant phrases or words that they use. And I pick those out and collect them, both the positive and the negative. And then we start to create something from that, because people give it away. If you listen, they give it away.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you have to listen a wee bit between the lines, like you read between the lines. Sometimes it's stuff that people don't say that is actually the
thing. I was going to say, is it, because sometimes what they verbalise isn't what they mean.
Indeed so.
Yeah. There's something here.
But if it's an event that's had an impact on them, they usually will describe it as they feel it. Mm. And it's the feeling I'm after, not the rationalisation.
Yeah, the post-rationalisation is, everyone can come up with it. I did this because, did you? There's something that everything we've spoken about so far, from the military, what a leadership is and the kind of etymology of it, there's like a we over me. If you are so insular that you can never, that's the lack of purpose, which then means why would anyone want to follow someone that's got no purpose? So there's this kind of cyclical logic there. But like, so how do you find that apart from Is there any other way apart from coaching, like getting out? Because how has COVID impacted that as well as? Cause what I've got here is, if you're not meeting someone, because I think about this in the workplace, how the hell does a young person now shadow? What does it look like to be good at work? Through Slack? I don't. You need to see how someone responds to a bad call. Like, so all this call for remote work is wonderful, or is it? How do we bridge that divide, or is that always going to be a huge gap and more work for coaches? I don't know, but
these are big questions. Mm-hmm. My course is called Back to Basics, Leadership Back to Basics. So let's just go back to basics here. I mean, essentially, as human beings, we are community oriented. We want to connect. We want to be with. We want to engage with. And yet, what's happening now is people are not doing that. And that's part of a protection mechanism. They're looking after themselves. But we need to reinstate the notion of community and collaboration and working together and thinking creatively as opposed to logically. Starting to reimagine how our lives could be, might be, should be, perhaps. And engaging collectively in this. We're not going to resolve these problems unless we engage collectively, because if people work in isolation, there is no synergy, there is no, there's no communication, or very little anyway. You don't have the stimulation of speaking to other people, of generating ideas through discussion, creation, challenge, and so on and so forth.
There's those water cooler moments, which I know kind of oversimplifies it, but it is that point of a passing conversation office, which you don't have when you're...
Because it's not a fully formed concept yet, you're thinking. Those water cooler moments are, just been thinking about this.
Yeah.
However, if we're only communicating over a text we won't share them necessarily because they should be more formed.
And a text, I suppose, can be misconstrued, or the subtext of what you don't say is difficult. It's far more hard to read those things in. And I think also what you said about community in like the workplace and everything, it's not even necessarily the ideas. It's that connection, that human connection of bouncing off people and just, you know, it's like when you haven't seen some people for a while and you go in and the shopkeeper's particularly nice when you buy a pint of milk and it does sort of lift you up a little bit. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
we're missing the human connection, but we're missing the recognition of humanity in another person. That seems to have somehow, I was going to use the word died, but I mean, that sounds a bit dramatic, but certainly...
Dying.
Yes, it's become subsumed by fear, I suspect. But, prisoners are put in isolation to punish them.
Yeah.
So you don't have to think too hard beyond that to know that it's not going to work ultimately. I mean, I've done a lot of work through the charity that I work for, the Hunger Project, with regard to training people at grassroots. And we run training courses in tiny villages in the middle of nowhere called Vision, Commitment and Action. And what happens is that the villagers, particularly the women, have that moment of realization where they discover that if they take responsibility and ownership for their lives, they can transform their lives. Mm. And they can shift themselves from being victims of circumstance to actually creating their own circumstances and generating their own circumstances. That is called empowerment. And it's not given. It's something you can do for yourself, but you need a bit of help. Now, people aren't empowered to empower today. It's all cut off. Mm. You do. I suppose, I mean, Brighton, I suppose, is entrepreneurial and more likely to have that kind of culture. But there are so many organisations where people are disempowered, not empowered. And people are disempowered if the culture doesn't recognise who they are, for instance. If the organisation doesn't know where it's going. Mm. Then you're kind of in this swirl of, I don't know, I mean, it just feels like people are going round and round in circles, like hamsters in a wheel, making the same mistakes time and time and time again, not learning from those mistakes. I mean, mistakes are a gift. Failure is a gift, and we regard it as something negative and bad and wrong. But you never learned to ride a bicycle until you fell off it. So it, falling off a bicycle in the world of riding bicycles is failure. But without that, how do you find your balance and how do you learn to ride a bicycle?
So you said you touched on it before. Do you think that's quite fear-driven with people? Because they're making the same mistakes again. They're not learning from them because they're afraid of speaking up or...
It's partly that, but it's partly that they don't have the conversations. Yeah. You know, what did we learn from this and how can we change... You know, make changes for the future. I mean, whoever listens to this is probably going to say that I'm exaggerating beyond belief. Well, fine, let them say that. However, I see this every day. It's just not happening. It's not happening. So why aren't we? You know, why aren't we engaging in making it, in creating a better future? And I don't necessarily mean that in the grandest sense. I actually mean it just individually in our communities, as families. I went to a conference on safeguarding on Tuesday. I mean, the despair in the teaching world. Mm. It's just terrible. Getting the message across to parents. The same parents turn up every time to whatever event is put on to try and help with safeguarding. And hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of others never do. And the view is that it's the teachers who should be parenting the kids, not the parents themselves. Yeah. I mean, who needs to go on training courses? It's the parents.
Mm. Yes.
Are you optimistic about leadership?
Yes.
Because?
I'm an optimist. Because I've seen change and I've made it happen. That's why.
So how did it all begin for you then, Helen? How did you first get interested in leadership and where did it start?
Okay, so in 1981 I attended a personal development program, which actually was kind of weird in our culture at the time. And
where are you now? So 1981, where in the world are you?
I'm in London. I was living in Twickenham. So I attend this programme 2 weekends, pretty hard work actually, and at the same time, completely mind-blowing. I mean, of course, I'd never come across anything like it before. And at this stage in my life, I had not decided what I wanted to pursue as a career. So the end of this course, I thought to myself rather arrogantly, well, if they can do it, so can I. But of course, there was no training. Mm. So I thought, well, I'll just have to make it up.
Was this self-driven? So you wasn't told to go there? You saw an ad or it wasn't?
A friend of mine told me about it and said you should go in the way that we do. So
something was driving you at that point to even look for that.
I was in the doldrums a bit, you know, and because I hadn't... there was something very seductive about it. There was something challenging about it that appealed to me. I do quite like a challenge now and again. And so I thought, I'll go. What the hell? It's an adventure, you know. I remember feeling at the end of the event that I had lifted the lid of the dustbin and looked out. You know, I'd had that experience. Mm. as opposed to looking
in.
Yeah. All of a sudden, whoa, there's this whole new world.
So it's quite transformative for you then, that course.
Massively. Yeah. Massively. But that was then the end of my struggle to find a career, because that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to help to transform people's lives in whatever way that was going to show up. So my first attempt, I put together some leaflets, 500 I printed, stood in Richmond High Street, handed them out a couple of Saturdays. 2 weeks later, I'd hired a church hall, 8 people showed up, and I ran my first course. And it was a huge success. But bear in mind, nothing like this was happening in England at the time, or certainly.
What was the audience that turned up there?
Random people, just off the street. I mean, adventurous people who decided, well, let's give it a crack and see what happens. But the training that I got when I joined the Hunger Project, which occurred concomitantly with completing this course, was bar none. Now, I've done lots of training since then. I've been on dozens and dozens of courses. I have now got coaching qualifications, formal coaching qualifications. But the training I received from the Hunger Project was better than any other I've ever had. And I will still continue to say that until somebody produces something different. It was extraordinary. Because I wanted to work for the Hunger Project, initially as a volunteer, I wanted to deliver their education program, they insisted on the training. And because we were dealing with a very contentious subject at the time, the attitude then is people didn't relate to hunger, they related to famine. Mm. And they related to famine as a means of controlling population. That was the answer I used to get, the most frequent answer I used to get. But actually what we were dealing with, and still are, is chronic persistent hunger and malnutrition, which is different from famine. Famine is 10% of the problem. So we needed some training in dealing with difficult questions and difficult people. And we also needed training in understanding the distinctions, and this is where language became so important to me, the distinctions between the different types of hunger. We needed to understand politics. We needed to understand all kinds of stuff. I mean, when I first started, 75,000 children were dying every 24 hours. So, and now it's completely different. It's not done, but it is a lot different. So that's what got me. That's what grabbed me. That if I can make a difference, if I can stop these people dying. And I remember the first time I had a conversation with the person who enrolled me, and I said, but what difference am I going to make? And he said, it's conceivable you might make the difference. Because if you think in terms of a bucket standing under a dripping tap, you don't know which drop is going to be the one to cause the bucket to overflow. Yeah. And you don't know when it's going to happen either.
No, which is a fantastic analogy, to be fair. So the Hunger Project, you're still involved with that now. You've been involved ever since.
Yes, I'm still involved peripherally. I'm not actively buzzing around. But funnily enough, I read an email this morning and thought, no, I think it's time I re-engaged a little bit. The Hunger Project focuses principally on the empowerment of women now, because we have found, time and time again, that when women are empowered, life changes.
Yeah.
And tremendous things happen, and girls get educated and so on. And the Hunger Project's strategy is to create what they call, they're not eco-centres, they're something else. It'll come to me in a minute. But anyway, a centre that is built by a whole collection of villages within a 10-mile radius. And the centre provides a schoolroom, birthing room, medicines. They have a grain store. They have a grinding room. They have a little bank. So they create it. They make it whatever they, you know, however they want it to be. But they've got the basics there in place. And that functions as a hub for that 10-mile radius. Do you remember I was talking? Exactly. Yeah. I was talking about community and bringing us together. Well, if you have a hub that draws people to it, then you've got more chance. So what sort of hubs should we be thinking about creating?
Mm. That's a good question.
Yeah, I'm not sure I particularly like that term, but you know what I mean anyway. Yeah.
There's something here. So are you still talking to the person that said you might be the difference? Is that person still involved in the hunger?
He's not actively involved in the Hunger Project anymore, but he is running transformational courses.
It's actually a huge thing, right? Because obviously there's a that mission, being mission driven. You obviously wanted to be there, so you're a sponge, and like, you know, you believed in their mission. But then for that person was a leader on, he not just being a trainer of the trainer, but he led you to then be on this 30-year kind of project.
Well, he was the one that made the difference with me. So how many more people could I make the difference with? I mean, I spoke to hundreds and hundreds of people, because our first job was to enroll as many people in the project, certainly to have people commit to the end of hunger as an idea whose time has come. And every single one of those people that we spoke to could be the last drop that, you know, overflowed the bucket. So it, when you think about it in those terms, it's a completely different framework. And I had when I was working in Russia, I tried to explain this. I was working in safety leadership on construction sites, and I would try and explain the concept using the bucket, and it worked. But they got it, that every one of you who works safely will influence the next one, and you never know which is the one. So it's if we understood that concept and fully appreciated it, breathed it, lived it, I think that could be transformational in huge ways
in terms of driving leadership change in this country, basically.
In those terms, but also in terms of recognizing that we could do anything. We could create massive transformation if we recognize that each one of us makes a difference, because otherwise you get resignation and indolence and avoidance and all those.
I suppose that is a thing to try and get people over that hurdle of, I'm only one person, what difference can I make, is probably quite a common thing for people to say, because they can't see
and
that.
They still do.
Yeah.
And
they still it makes it.
But do you know, and I know from Children in Need, for instance,
yes,
that hundreds and hundreds of people all over the country find themselves doing something, initiating something. So if you take the view, I can't make a difference, that's it, you're going to come to a stop.
So just going back to something you said there about, how did you end up in Russia?
I was about to, but there's some stories there.
Well, it was my most surprising gig. But at this point, I was working as a self-employed consultant with a safety leadership organisation. And this opportunity came up to go and work in Russia. And nobody wanted to go. And my boss said, I can't get anyone to go. I said, oh, I'll go. it's a huge consortium, pipeline consortium, that runs from Kazakhstan through to the Black Sea. And they were building pump stations all along the pipeline in order to speed up the export of oil. And I was working, well, I worked on four or five pump stations, I think, in the end. But essentially, we were there to help people to transform their attitudes to leadership, to safety. The Russian statistics were appalling at the time. They were losing 11,000 people a year in heavy industry.
Gosh.
And the population of Russia is not very big, given that it spans 11 or 12 time zones. And their culture it goes against safety in some respects.
Okay.
Because they feel they have to keep themselves on edge, ready for anything, in case they're invaded or in case something, you know, because of their history. And so they take risks intentionally to keep the blade sharpened, so to speak. Hmm. And we had to try and persuade them that this was not a great plan. So I loved it. I just had a ball. I mean, I was living in dust and freezing cold and steaming hot in porter cabins. The food was terrible. But
what
I had
what
a team.
Time? When is this? What?
2011 to 2016.
Okay.
So fairly recent then.
Yeah.
My best gig.
So I thought when you said, like, you know, appalling safety records, I thought we were going back to like the 80s or 90s or something. That's quite as shocking that it's still that's
and 36,000 people dying on the roads.
So do you think you made a difference? Do you think that you managed to encourage them to change their working practices?
We know we did, because we know now a lot of the changes have stuck.
Yeah.
We absolutely knew for sure that we'd made a difference. Yeah. It was not huge. It was probably about a third of the people involved, but we did.
It's still progress, isn't it? It's still a third better on than you were before,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. And that was then. Yeah. I mean, it's much better now, I suspect.
Yeah. Difficult to know now, I suppose. But
well, I'm not in touch with them.
Yeah.
The client any longer, so I couldn't say. But certainly, I know that the main contractor adopted our ideas, and trying to run their own training courses, copying us. So, because they saw that it was a seller.
Mm. So we are coming to the end of the podcast now. So I just wanted to sort of ask you very quickly about if you have any examples, really, of places where you've gone into to help, where you've seen real change. Not you've obviously given the example of the Russian project, for want of a better description, but there are other ones where you've gone in and you've found a culture which is lacking completely, but you've managed to implement some positive transformation in there.
Well,
I suppose ones that you're particularly proud of, perhaps.
Well, the Russian one for sure, no question, because most of the time I was single-handedly doing it. I had a team of safety engineers with me. They were Russian, so I was running the show, and it was down to me. I had to make it happen.
Yeah.
The Hunger Project is another place, although that's not business-oriented particularly. But I'm just trying to think. I've worked with so many organisations. I can actually think of another example, Winchester Prison, where I worked both with prisoners and staff, and that was a huge success. Mm. Huge success, because I was able to introduce the idea of trust to prisoners, of self-worth, self-confidence, and I was able to work on the difference between leadership and management with the staff, and communication skills, and just ways, different ways of relating to each other that improved the situation. Mm. And I mean, that was a success. But there were I'm sorry, it sounds like I'm bragging. I mean, I've worked with so many organisations, I can't keep count. I mean, I've worked in engineering, pharmaceutical, I worked with Coca-Cola, I worked with Unilever. Now, Unilever is another example. We supported them to introduce a new IT system in a division of Unilever. And it was an absolute corker. It was brilliant. It really worked. But it worked because we employed this methodology. And communication is key. Your leadership is a relational activity. Mm. You need to be able to build relationships in order to then enroll people and take them with you. So if you're not up for that, it's not going to be very successful. So law firms, I remember one particular law firm where there were 15 senior partners, one of whom was a woman, and they had 30 administrators, one of whom was male. And I was able to transform the relationship between the senior partners and the administration department so that it then worked in a fulfilling manner for both both ends. Prior to that, it was a very, very uncomfortable relationship. So.
Well, it's been fascinating hearing about leadership and your thoughts on it. So thank you so much for coming onto the podcast, Helen.
Just from my side, thank you for the conversation. That was wonderful. And where can people find you online?
Well, first of all, thank you. And it's been a great pleasure. You might have sensed that I can talk about this happily and readily any time. They can find me on LinkedIn. EllenGuinness.com is my website. So they can catch me. I've made myself available.
Super.
Thank you.
Hubbub, the Directors Hub podcast, sponsored by the Sussex Business Show.